Then I'll come to order. Roll call.
Roll call for Thursday, January 10th. Anderson, District 2.
Here.
Anderson, District 28.
Here.
Barnard.
Here.
Bebout.
Here.
Burns.
Here.
Case.
Present.
Christensen.
Here.
Coe.
Here.
Cooper.
Here.
Kraft.
Here.
Dockstader.
Here.
Driscoll.
Here.
Emmerich.
Here.
Esquibel.
Present.
Geis.
Here.
Hastert.
Here.
Hicks.
Here.
Hines.
Here.
Johnson.
Here.
Landon.
Here.
Meyer.
Here.
Nicholas.
Here.
Nutting.
Here.
Perkins.
Here.
Peterson.
Here.
Rothfuss.
Here.
Schiffer.
Here.
Scott.
Here.
Von Slatern.
Here.
President Ross.
Here.
30 present.
Prayer by Reverend Veit.
Better turn on the deal.
Today I'd like to offer you a prayer for guidance. Still uses the old English, so bear with me, but perhaps it'll remind us of our roots and our traditions. So let us pray. Direct us, O Lord, in all our doings with thy most gracious favor, and further us with thy continual help, that in all our works begun, continued, and ended in thee, we may serve the people of Wyoming faithfully and always glorify your name. Amen.
Amen. Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Reading, correction, and approval of the journal. Will the reading clerk please read the journal committee report?
Mr. President, your journal committee reports that the journal of January the 9th, 2013, has been read and recommends that it be approved. Senator Jim L. Anderson, Chairman.
Well, are there any objections? There being none, the report is adopted. There is no doctor or nurse for today. They seem to have ditched us. On this day in Wyoming history, 1891, the Great Seal of the State for Wyoming was authorized and passed by the state legislature. Today's thought for today comes from Martin Luther King. The ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy. Members of the Senate, today we are honored to have Major General Luke Reiner joining us to introduce three people who are an important part of our nation's defense. These civilian employers of military personnel represent a necessary part of the Wyoming Military Department. General, if you would please introduce us to those individuals you have brought here today.
Thank you, Mr. President. Distinguished Senators, first of all, thank you for inviting us here today, and we thank you for your consistent and solid support of the Wyoming National Guard. The support that Wyoming demonstrates for its military is absolutely among the best in the nation. We don't take that lightly, and we're very grateful. Today, I'd like to introduce representatives from what we consider an integral component of the Wyoming Military Department, our civilian employers. Most of your National Guard soldiers and airmen are part-time soldiers. They're part-time warriors. They're part-time airmen. Their civilian employers, those I will introduce today, sacrifice when their military employees are called to train and deploy. Yet the majority of them are among our strongest supporters. Without the many civilian employers who support our dual state and federal mission, we would not have soldiers and airmen to fill sandbags during flooding events throughout the state. We would not have the personnel to drop 3,000 gallons of fire retardant in one C-130 pass on raging wildfires. We would not have enough men and women to sustain our support of our nation's overseas conflicts. And we would not have had the successes that we have had in the last 12 years of war. Let me introduce the following civilian employers to you. Mr. Darren Hass is the human resource officer at the Cheyenne Regional Medical Center. The medical center employs multiple National Guard and Reserve members in many departments. In fact, this morning I talked to him over 50. In 2011, the center was nominated for the Freedom Award, which is the highest award given by the Secretary of Defense to civilian employers. So thank you, Mr. Hass. I'd like to introduce Laramie County Sheriff Danny Glick. His department and himself have been an outstanding employer, receiving many employer support of the Guard and Reserve Patriot Awards over the years. The Patriot Award is presented based on a nomination by a service member to say thank you to their employer for their support. So thank you very much, Sheriff. And Mr. Tracy Tricado is the Director of Human Resources at Great Lakes Airlines. Great Lakes has continuously hired National Guard and Reserve personnel since locating to Cheyenne. The company fully supports all military service, ensuring service members are able to meet all training and deployment needs. So thank you very much, Mr. Tricado. Mr. Speaker, these people and the companies they represent are examples of what I am pleased to say is the norm for Wyoming employers. I am proud to consider civilian employers an important part of our success. Sir, thank you very much for your time.
Major General Reiner, thank you so much for joining us in the Senate today and allowing us to honor these outstanding Wyoming citizens. I also want to thank the current and former members of the military that are in the gallery today. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your service to Wyoming and the nation, and we honor you. Introduction, reading, and reference of bills. Excuse me. Senator Landon.
Mr. President, may I have privilege of the floor?
Yes, please. You may.
Thank you, Mr. President. This being Military Day, I thought it might be appropriate, and I hope it's a good thing that I stand and recognize a good friend back home. Yesterday, you might have read in the newspaper that yesterday my home county recognized somebody in a very special way, a gentleman by the name of Stan Lowe. He's a very good friend to many of us, and we are so proud of that man. And yesterday they established a scholarship in his honor up at the college in Casper, and I just wanted to send a shout out to Stan Lowe and congratulate him and thank him for everything that he's done for our military and for our country. So keep it going, Stan. Congratulations.
Yeah. Yeah. Senate File 58, first reading of the Senate file.
Senate File 58, driver's license suspension for child support non-payment, sponsored by Senator Johnson. An act relating to child support enforcement.
Senate File 58 is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Senate File 101, first reading of the bill.
Senate File 101, Child Abuse Reporting Penalties, sponsored by Senator Nutting, and Act Relating to Children.
Senate File 101 is referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Senate File 96, first reading of the bill.
Senate File 96, Compulsory School Attendance, sponsored by Senator Rothfuss, and Act Relating to Compulsory School Attendance.
Senate File 96 is referred to Committee Number 4, Education. Senate File 95, first reading of the bill.
Senate File 95, High School Graduation Requirements, sponsored by Senator Rothfuss, an act relating to high school graduation requirements.
Senate File 95 is referred to Committee Number 4, Education. Senate File 104, first reading of the bill.
Senate File 104, Education, State Administration, sponsored by Senator Cole, and Act Relating to Government Administration.
Senate File 104 is referred to Committee Number 4, Education. Senate File 94, first reading of the bill.
Senate File Number 94, Public Library Endowment Challenge Program Extension, and sponsored by Senator Schiffer, an act relating to the Wyoming Public Library Endowment Challenge Program.
Senate File 94 is referred to Committee Number 4, Education. Senate File 90, first reading of the bill.
Senate File 90, Administrative Control of Acquired Institutional Lands, sponsored by Senator Bebout, and Act Relating to State Lands.
Senate File 90 is referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. Senate File 93, first reading of the bill.
Senate File 93, Use of Cell Phones While Driving, sponsored by Senator Escobel, an act relating to motor vehicles.
Senate File 93 is referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation. Senate File 103, first reading of the bill.
Senate File 103, Electronic Cigarettes, sponsored by Senator Escobel, and act relating to child protection.
Senate File 103 is referred to Committee Number 10, Labor. Reports from standing committees.
January the 9th, 2013, Mr. President, your Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, Military Affairs, to whom was referred Senate File 46, Protecting Veterans' Disability Compensation in Divorce, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Cooper, Landon, Schiffer, Von Fladern. No, Senator Escobel, Senator Von Fladern, Chairman. January the 9th, 2013, Mr. President, your Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, to whom was referred Senate File 44, First Responder Retirement Account Payment Rules, reports back with the recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Cooper, Escobel, Landon, Schiffer, Von Fladern, Senator Von Fladern, Chairman. January the 9th, 2013, Mr. President, your Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, Military Affairs, to whom was referred Senate File 45, Restricted Driver's License Modifications. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Cooper, Escobel, Landon, Schiffer, Von Kleteren, Senator Von Kleteren, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, first an announcement, and then I'd like to ask for privilege of the floor. With respect to the photographer here for our annual composites, we'll be here today and tomorrow. The photographs are taken down in the basement conference room that'd be on the east side of the Capitol, I believe. The 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., so you need to make arrangements, each of you, to get down and get those photographs taken so that when the president gets his picture in the middle, you'll all be surrounded looking well. If there are no other announcements, Mr. President, I'd like to have the privilege of the floor just to go through some charts that the LSO has put together for us.
You may have privilege of the floor.
Thank you.
Are you going to speak at this? Okay. I can help you.
Mr. President, this morning I handed out to you a couple things that came from, developed by the legislature, and they really, first of all, the sheets that came out were the Tax 2000 report. I just want to talk a little bit about that, tell you the reasons why I brought that out, and then there are a series of charts, and I'll pull up the charts as we're talking through, but you've got a physical copy of it, and, you know, I'm mindful of the fact that I'm your majority floor leader, and the purpose is not to get up here and tell you what my biases are with respect to these funds, but for all of us that went through and lived through Tax 2000, at that time, I think there wasn't a member on either floor that was not conversant in the things that I'm going to go through. As we move to the budget, that will be the Senator Bebout's chairman's responsibility as we move on. These are all concepts that everybody should know. There was, like I say, there was a time when everybody knew them. And if I have biases as I go through, they're really biases that was developed because we had this bipartisan effort to develop the really an analysis of all of our accounts, our tax bases, where we were going, and why we arrived at it. A lot of these concepts are embedded into the accounts. I see we're also this morning you have an explanation of the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund, the allocations into the various accounts. And my thought, Mr. President, is over the course of the week before the budget gets out that we go over some of these accounts little by little so that everybody, by the time the budget comes out, has a deep understanding, as strong as anybody on the floor, what these accounts did and why we were doing it. The first chart that, when you look at these charts that come out, the first one prepared by is, and we talked about what is the Legislative Stabilization Reserve Account. That name, folks, was a very specific name that this body put together, put to that account, the LISRA account. We did not call it the rainy day account. We didn't call it the rainy seasons account. We called it the Legislative Stabilization Reserve Account. And it was to provide for predictable revenue cycles because we have identified revenue cycles. And it was intended to augment the general fund and budget reserve accounts, both accounts that you're very familiar with, during anticipated long-term plateaus of slow or declining revenues at or near current operating expenses. And it's a good time then to look at what Tax 2000 said, and you've got the report that was provided to you. Now, when you look at Tax 2000, not everybody's going to read it the same. Not everybody's going to come to the same conclusion as what remains relevant and what's not relevant. For those that lived through that process, we know that the final analysis is that our Wyoming taxes were less stable than other states. This is on page 6 of the report. Page 8, that we do not have a balanced tax system. Page 11, our tax system may contribute to a lack of economic growth in the state. Page 11 is that our tax structure results in public infrastructure and larger public services per capita than if Wyoming residents had to pay for them entirely. Pages 12 through 13, the analysis of Wyoming does not divert enough of its mineral taxes to trust funds in order to secure public services funding for future generations. Part of the conclusion of Tax 2000, again, it was a bipartisan effort over 2 years, is that we should generate other sources of revenue and allow a greater percentage of our permanent mineral trust fund, the 1% diversion, to go into and build the trust fund. And this is a topic we'll all debate, and that is, do we continue to build the trust fund? How fast do you develop it? But in this issue, it was strongly debated and analyzed during Tax 2000. Another finding is future revenue streams may not be adequate to fund the services provided by state and local governments. What I'd like to show you, on your handouts, you've got this chart that was developed by, I know you all can't see it, but you've all got the handout in the in your packet. The significance of this is what we asked the staff to do. So our budget staff went back and created a chart. It's the second one in your sheets. And we asked them to look at the profile that we had had. And what we were really interested in is what happened in the 1980s that led to the development of the first, what we call, rainy day accounts. How are those funds dissipated? And what was the environment of Tax 2000? So Tax 2000 is right here before this first jump. Now, I think part of the point is that Tax 2000 came and said, look, we're going to have to raise new revenues. There were three sources of revenues that brought up: income tax, corporate income tax. The second was taxes on services, attorney's fees, those sorts of things. And the third area was a real estate transfer tax. We were going to have to do all or some of those in order to raise revenues because we simply had no resources. So at this point, before this first jump, was Tax 2000. And what the significance of this plateau here is that the plateaus are not flat. I mean, you can see that there was the dark blue is general fund. The light blue is the budget reserve account, so those are our operating accounts. And you can see that starting in the early or the mid-80s, all the way through Tax 2000, it wasn't declining revenues. It wasn't plateaued. Rather, it was a slow increase. But some of the things that we know during this time is that, first of all, we ran out of money. The folks are... Our predecessors during the early 80s developed $1 billion in the rainy day accounts and their various different accounts. I can recall talking to my colleagues, my uncle who served during that time, Senator Scott will testify that the idea is if you had enough of your reserves, you could operate for 2 years, the entire budget, on the resources you had. And it was a good marker of what they thought a rainy day would be. Well, that $1 billion was expended between about 87, and it was all gone by about 1995. In addition, the 1% diversion, statutory diversion, it was going into the permanent mineral trust fund back here. It was somewhere along here. It was pulled out and put into the operating fund. Now, when we had this big revenue increase spike here, that 1% by the legislature was put back into the permanent mineral trust fund to build the size of the fund. The capital facilities bond prison financing, there was not enough to build for the capital, the prison. So in about this time, I think it was during the Governor Geringer's term, we actually paid for the prison addition about $90 million in Rawlins by borrowing the money through it was a lease purchase option. One of the first things that happened in, as these increases came is we paid off those bonds. So we're largely debt-free now. But once again, during this phase, there was not sufficient enough to meet those capital needs. Also during this time, to generate revenues, the state converted its accounting system from a cash-based system to an accrual basis that essentially brought forward about $40 million of realized, not realized, but income that was essentially treated on the books. You can only do that once. It's done, but that was, they created two accounts, the GAAP one, general accounting principles account one and two, and those funds then were also dissipated and utilized from about here to about the 98 to 1000. We benefited from what was called the sponge tax, but lawyers called it. So there was a federal income tax at the time, or excuse me, death tax, and with the federal inheritance tax, there was a credit to states, and if you taxed up to that credit, then you could keep it, and we called that the sponge tax, or the sponged up part of the federal inheritance tax. And you all recall the lady who was a Georgia, passed away in Georgia and was taxed in Jackson Hole. And we picked up a significant amount from her estate that got us through one of these years towards the end. We increased fuel tax, severance tax swap to K-12. Now, during this time, one of the significant factors is from about 94, maybe earlier, all the way through these spikes in revenues, we were having to supplement the education account, the school foundation program account, about $100 million a biennium. That meant the first day you would walk in, right off the top of your table was, or off your general fund was the amount required to operate the education account. Now it's been well, we'll show you a chart what's happening to that account, but it's largely, again, funded by federal mineral royalties, so it's energy dependent. So, when Tax 2000 was looking at their recommendations from this point to this point, and this is my point of when we talked, we created the Legislative Stabilization Reserve account, we were looking at large, long periods where our revenues, our expenditures had reached, by the way, the red line are your expenditures, and the below are the revenues, or the two shaded are your revenues. So when you look at the expenditure lines, you can see the expenditures were climbing, and they do naturally. And when you begin to look at that expenditure, that long growth area where there was growth, at the time that we hit 98 to 99 to tax 2000 study, our teacher salaries were the lowest in the nation. My recollection is state employee salaries were about 70% of the market. We had an enormous backlog of capital construction needs, highway deferred maintenance. Almost everybody in this room remembers those times. Now, what avoided the taxes, or the need to go to the taxes this year, this bump, is when the legal issues and capacity to develop coal bed methane commenced. So coal bed methane gave us this first big bump, then we had a drop. Then this large spike here is revenue primarily from deep gas, principally from the Jonah field and later the Pinedale Anticline. And when you see this large spike up here, almost most of us were around at that time, and that's where you have $8 MCF gas. Now, the question is, I mean, the point that I've been trying to make is that when you look at Tax 2000 at this point and look backwards, the question that we have to ask ourselves, are we essentially at this point looking forward? So they were looking backwards at what we have to look forward. And that's the discussion we need to have. So we asked the staff to prepare us what the fiscal profile looks going forward. First of all, this chart you all are quite familiar with by now, because it's been handed out multiple times throughout the years, but we've only looked at a short period, essentially the rise of natural gas. We see that our ongoing expenses jumped up very rapidly in this area. A large part of that was increased support for the community colleges, higher education, the University of Wyoming. Department of Health had a huge increase in mental health and substance abuse. We also brought in the acquired brain injury waivers, things like that. So we did a lot for our citizens in this area. And you'll remember that we've talked about, you know, in the ongoing expenses here, the largest share, 60 to 70%, are in three big categories: corrections, health, and higher education, the university and the community colleges. The revenue plateau goes sort of like this, and the difference between our expenditures and the revenue, which is the white, most of that is what's filled up and created the legislative stabilization reserve account. So most of that, the difference between, we appropriated what Craig estimated. In many instances, we had more revenue coming in, and some of that is from just gas revenues being higher, natural gas higher than we thought. Some of it is because we're not recognizing all the capital gains off of the permanent mineral trust fund until the equities are actually sold, the income is realized. The combination of those have created the white gaps, and that's what's filled your rainy day account. Now, part of the point of this chart is to show that our revenues are coming down, and our expenditures are, while we're bringing them down or plateauing them, are ongoing, are still going up. And at some point, if we don't make some corrections, the revenues come down and the expenditures may cross each other. And the question is, will that happen? And if so, when? And this is the next chart that staff has offered for us. And this is now looking forward. So when you begin to look at this forward, now there are a lot of assumptions in this, and you're free to talk to the staff to learn more about this chart. Because, for example, it does not include unforecasted capital gains. So the capital gains from the permanent mineral trust fund will not be in here because they're not at this point estimated revenues, because we don't estimate them until they're received. This is, though, the profile of the revenues against expenditures, and this is based upon current Craig estimates. And what we're being told by experts, the Revenue Committee, Minerals Committee, and the JAC have all heard testimony that gas prices are likely to plateau or hold in the $4 to $5 range for the next 10 years. So that gets you back to where we're expecting, that revenues will increase, much like they did before we hit this phenomena. We'll call it the Tax 2000 phenomena. But our expenditures, if you assume 5% assumed growth, based upon the governor's current recs, these are based upon the governor's recs that are in his budget. So you take the governor's recs and assume 5% growth for the Department of Health, which would be quite ambitious to hit that, and assume growth of all other expenditures of 3%. So we kept them to 3%, and we flatlined the extras. So the flatlined extras would be cities, towns, and counties, economic development, all of the things on that first chart that are above the yellow. We flatline all of those, and what you can see is we cross in about 2018, we have a problem that we need to move forward with. that we have to deal with. Now, another concern is this is the general fund and the budget reserve account. What's happening to our education account? The school foundation program account profile looks much like this. And what, again, we have the revenues on top, the expenditures down below. The green is school capital construction, and the purple are the foundation program account. And you can see the revenues are going up here, and again, the largest source of revenues are federal mineral royalties that are earmarked to this account, the school foundation program account. When you look at the white, that is the differential between what is the expenditures and the revenue. That's what funded the Hathaway Scholarship Program. It funded the higher education endowment accounts. And more recently, some of it has ended up into what is we're calling that holding account. It's on the spreadsheet. I want to say the Common School holding account. So we have a sweep going from the school foundation program account into the capital construction account and then the holding account. And part of the idea was to the extent that we have these excess revenues, maybe consider putting those into the Common School Permanent Land Fund, which is only about $1.5 billion, certainly inadequate to begin or to cover all these, but to try to build that trust fund, which has not had any real increases or new contributions since the state was created. If we lose a dollar of natural gas valuation, this line will come down and hit this line. And at that, with $1 reduction in minerals, we're told that we will then maybe underwater in this account. Now, hopefully that won't happen, but it shows that we have to be cautious of our expenditures, and it also shows that there are, when you start forecasting it out here, we have to pay attention to whether or not these revenues are going to be sufficient to pay all these costs. So with respect to the revenues off of the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund, this is the chart that I want you to focus on, again, created by staff. So with this chart, back in the late 80s, early 90s, about 25% of our our operating budget came from revenues off of the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund. Since that time, the amount of contribution of the earnings off of the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund have declined substantially. Partly because our budget's gone up and the revenues off of the account are not adequate to keep that 25% margin. And we've done some other things. You recall we have the 5% spending policy, which is described in this other handout that came out this morning. I'll talk about that later as weeks come on. But what we've done is we've kind of interrupted that 5%, so we're only forecasting. In this year, as an example, we forecasted about $130 million of revenue off of our fixed income, and that's profiled in. But if we receive more income up to the 5% spending policy, which is about $230 million, that extra $100 million actually is swept into the rainy day account. So that's been one of the sources of building the rainy day account or the LISRA account. But for all practical purposes, one of the objectives of some folks is to try to get this account, the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund, grown to a size where if we reach, if you end up having a plateau for multi-years, 6 to 7 years, that we can get it back to where, if needed, we can get as much as 25% of our budget off of the revenues from that account. So, folks, My suggestion to you is that you take a look at and read the Tax 2000 report with in mind that really We've done a lot of the things that are in that report, but the major structural issues, nothing's changed. We did not implement an income tax, nor a tax on services, nor a real estate transfer tax. We remain dependent on our gas production and mineral production. And part of what we've had the opportunity to do is to interrupt that discussion of whether or not we have a balanced tax base with the wonderful explosion of natural gas. And what we do now will depend on what we're trying to do, and what we all need to figure out how to do, is how to take advantage of those revenues on a long-term basis to prevent us from having to have the Tax 2000 discussion once again.
Thank you, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, let me first compliment the Majority Floor Leader on excellent and really informative presentation. And I want to ask a question about another peril I see out there financially, and that is when we look at our various revenue sources and our investments and the things we own, how well protected are we against a major inflation? And the reason I ask is I'm getting increasingly concerned with the way the Federal Reserve is essentially printing money with these quantitative easing programs to finance the national operating deficits. And they're doing it on a scale that makes me think that they're essentially going to wind up debasing the currency, which is a strategy that has never in history worked out very well in the long term. How well protected are we looking at both our investments and our income sources if something like that happens to us over the next 6-8 years?
Mr. President, when I think about that issue, the first thing you have to think about is your tax base. And if you hit the inflationary components, what happens to your tax revenue base? You know, assumingly, if you have a high inflation, incomes go up, and so many states would be insulated somewhat by an income tax, which we don't have. So our largest revenues are from minerals. And if you hit that inflationary period, the question is, do your commodity prices go up commensurate with the devaluation of your dollar, so you're paying more for your commodities? Or are commodities going to hit stabilized? And one of the things that we saw in the high inflation period of the 90s, and we've got mineral experts here that are more knowledgeable than I am, but my recollection is we had a high inflationary period. You'll all remember when interest hit 18%. We had huge, the stock market was going out of the roof, and partly because mineral prices at that time were held down. So if you have this inflationary period and your commodity prices are held down in order to drive up your stock market, then you're going to have a problem because you compound our dependency on commodities through that period of time. The other thing, revenue sources significantly, are sales and use taxes. The property taxes, if your property values go up, that primarily benefits local governments. But remember, on the sales and use tax, we gave a larger percentage to the cities, towns, and counties as a trade-off when we went through de-earmarking. And we have less sales and use tax available at the state level. Presumably, if inflation goes up, your cost of services go up, and your sales and use taxes would go up commensurately. Having said that, those are your sources of revenue. When you look at the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund, our fixed income is subject to deflation, whereas our equities should benefit from a rising stock market under those circumstances, which is the reason why we can we changed the policy back in it was at that time Treasurer Loomis's term to be able to invest up to half of the permanent mineral trust fund and other trust funds in equities. So that's a long question. I think we always have problems because of our tax base, and the problem could be accentuated.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. President. I thought that was a very good answer. I might take small exception with the notion that the remark about commodity prices being held down. I think that we actually suffer because we're a commodity-producing state, that the natural state of commodity prices probably is to move towards market levels. And the freer markets are, the lower those prices will tend to be over time. And we suffer the ravages of market fluctuations and things. But truly, the change in the natural gas market and the new techniques of deep and directional and fracking have completely changed the situation, not just in the United States. First we thought, what a miracle, it's happening in Wyoming. This is so good for us. We're going to have this edge. Truth is, the technology was fully transferable throughout the United States and throughout the world.
And folks, remember that our resident economist brings skills to this, and you need to listen to our economists.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll be rather brief, and I'd like to compliment the majority floor leader. Among all your other skills and talents, you're a great teacher as well. Kind of following on the comments that were made earlier by our resident economist, I had the privilege of recently spending some time with some reputable gas marketers, and I can't use their name on the floor, and I'll share this with you later. But in line with what the senator from Fremont County said, we need to really attend to the market share in regard to natural gas. And what I show you here, if you'll see the top red line, you'll see a decline. That's gas being produced in the Rockies. All the other lines are going up. Those are the other gas production zones. As the good economist in the corner has said, these new techniques and drilling and whatnot have brought many other plentiful markets on the scene, and many of our pipelines and other things that go into these distant areas are now being fed by their resident gas supply. So we need to attend to this market share. And what it leaves for us is we're going to have to go to an even more distant market, in that we're going to have to start exploring, I think, perhaps, and their advice to these folks, international markets. And so this is something that we're going to take some initiative on, and this window of opportunity is going to close pretty rapidly as these gas supplies off the coast of Africa, Southern California, and these other places come into the world market. It's even going to isolate us more. And so we really have to attend to some of the things that we've been told in regard to price, but market share is going to be, something that we're going to have to attend to. I'll share this information with you. Ask these individuals to come and do a noon presentation and whatnot, but I think it's critical and it's imminent. Thank you, Mr.
Senator Bebout.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. President. And just to add a couple things and to talk about my colleague from Natrona County's comments about the dollar, one of the concerns as you look to the future that I think we have to visit about is that right now crude oil is traded in dollars. And there's a lot of discussion about moving from that arena and trading it in some other currency. That's bad news for oil, but the good news for us is oil is not the driving force in our revenue stream. It's gas. And my colleague from Fremont County talks about what's going on in the whole northern hemisphere. There's increased production of gas. The pricing of gas is probably going to stay on the dollar in that for that reason, because it's a regional thing, whereas crude oil is a worldwide thing. The thing that's really important for us on the gas side, getting back to what the former president was talking about, is you take a price of an MCF of gas today at Opal. I checked this morning. It was, I think, $3.23.
that same MCF of gas over in Japan is worth about $11 or $12. That's in U.S. dollars. You know, the real bottom line of that is we could see some hits to us, but overall, I think the gas side of it is going to be enough to offset anything that might happen with oil if they get away from trading oil in dollars.
Senator Scott and then Senator Hicks.
Mr. President, one further comment on the inflation risk. The previous inflation was primarily a wage price spiral. If you get an inflation due to excessive printing of money by the Federal Reserve to finance deficits, I think you're much more likely to have an asset-driven inflation. And we should be better protected against that, but then we have to heed special local factors that, such as been talked about our potential gas prices, and you can always have a general commodity-driven inflation where your particular commodity, our particular commodity, doesn't participate in it. So there still remain some risks, but we should be a little better protected on the revenue side in an inflation caused by printing of too many dollars. That's different from a wage price spiral inflation.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. President, members, I share my colleagues' concern that our government is trying to debase our currency right now. If we've gone through three rounds of quantitative easing, every time we've done this, there's almost two-thirds more money supply out there today, and those are paper dollars. And what I want to talk about is this chart right here that we just looked at. Back during the last period, 25% of all the revenues of the state of Wyoming come out of that permanent Wyoming Mineral Trust Fund. If you go to the state, Secretary of State's webpage right now, we have over $15 billion invested in the state's money. But those $15 are currency. And one of the things I think we need to take a strategic look at, and I've talked to some of the people within the Treasury Department, is how do you secure and protect those investments that I think the gentlemen are talking about? How are we going to provide that security? And I think at some point in time, we are a commodity-driven state, and the way we protect our investments is start moving some of those investments into tangible money and start moving them out of currency. And what we mean by that is commodities. And right now, throughout the history of the world, the single thing that has continued to beat inflation over and over again is commodities, primarily precious metals. But in this case, it's going to be driven by oil. And I think we need to start thinking, how do we protect that $15 billion investment that at one time was providing 25% of all the revenues for the state of Wyoming? Because the single biggest hedge against inflation, and inflation is a monetary currency, this has been money. And we're talking real tangible assets, whether that be oil or precious minerals. But I think it's some time to start thinking right now, because I can tell you, if you look at all the world economists, we're looking at a debasement of the U.S. dollar and losing that as a world reserve currency. So it's dramatic times we're facing, and I think those dramatic times call for a reevaluation. And when I talk to the state treasurer's office, right now there's nothing that precludes the state of Wyoming for investing in commodities, part of that $15 billion, except for there's a policy that right now that the top five in that investment said we're not going to invest in commodities. But again, to hedge against future inflation and protect that $15 billion that's right now invested in paper currency, I think we need to start rethinking that position within the state of Wyoming.
Well, it was not our intent to have a full-fledged debate here, so all right. Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. President. I just question from the majority floor leader. The way I understand it, Majority Floor Leader, is that in the PMTF we have two values. We have the cost basis for the money that's in there, and then we have a market value of the amount of money in there. And you know, ultimately these numbers play up and down, and they'll have an effect on the value or the ability for that fund to earning power. So could you tell us maybe how they played that into this forecast here? I mean, how did they because ultimately those markets are going to go up and down and have an effect on the earnings power of that. Was that kind of played into that? Can you tell us?
Mr. President, what I'd like to do is hold that later. I do think that it would be a good discussion to talk about the permanent mineral trust fund, the 5% spending policy, what we've done to interrupt that policy, and talk about the tipping of the sprawl accounts. But I think we will create some charts to make that discussion flow easier. I think that's all information that you need to have later. So if we would defer those questions to later, let me wrap it up, Mr. President, and talk about when the governor has made and asked us to take an analysis of at least three different accounts and the fund flows that presently provided in the budget. Coal lease bonuses, the 1% statutory diversions of severance taxes into the permanent mineral trust fund, and he's also asked us to examine unrealized and then to-be-realized capital gains that are a result of rebalancing the permanent mineral trust fund. And those are all concepts we need to have well understood before we get to the budget, so I propose that we would provide for a session on each of those to make sure everybody understands what we're talking about and we're all in the same playing field when we have those discussions. There are a lot of important things with respect to natural gas. That is, we go back to the differentials between our gas and other states, the volumes that are available from Wyoming, the effect of the Bakken, the Marcellus, and other natural or dry gas plays, oil, where you're producing oil and you're getting gas. You should be paying attention to those things. One of the things I would like you to do, and we haven't had a lot of discussion about it, but when you read Tax 2000, one of the common acronyms were Legislative Designated Investments, LDIs. And LDIs are, for example, when we allocate a portion of the permanent mineral trust fund to be lent to starting farmers. If you do that below the market rates that we can achieve, that's a legislative designated investment. And we have a lot of legislative designated investments, and you have to realize when we do these LDIs, there's an impact on the amount of revenues that you get off the permanent mineral trust fund. And the time when you really notice those things is when you're looking more to the revenues from that account. And we have sort of strayed away from considering those terms, but you should command that to your understanding, and you'll see that in Tax 2000, the issue of LDIs, legislative designated investments, and whether or not we should designate those investments, we should provide them to folks, or whether we should get into the investment policies, those are all appropriate for other discussions.
Thank you, Mr. George.
With that, Mr. President, I would move that we move into the Committee of the Whole.
You've heard the motion that we are at that order of business, consideration of bills on general file. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is carried. Senator Cooper, would you please approach the desk?
Consideration is Senate File 3. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 3, State Oil and Gas Supervisor Qualifications, sponsored by the Mineral Committee, an act relating to oil and gas. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senator Anderson, 02. Senators Cole, Cooper, Hines, and Rothfuss. Senator Hines, Chairman.
You heard the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it does so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 3. There are no standing committee amendments, and I'll move the bill and yield to Senator Rothfuss to explain the bill.
Senator Rothfuss, as soon as I find you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this bill comes as a way of remedying a situation which we have right now where it's difficult to find a suitably qualified applicant for our chief administrator of the Oil and Gas Commission. It's a short piece of legislation that changes the requirements. You can see on page 2 is the heart of this piece of legislation, where it removes the requirement on lines 2 and 3 that the applicant be a registered professional petroleum engineer, petroleum geologist, and adds on lines 3 through 5 the requirement that the individual have at least 10 years of experience in his respective field of expertise instead of that professional requirement. Now, Mr. Chairman, the justification here is that the original intent of requiring a registered professional is so that you can stamp basically federal projects. It's a requirement and a common credential that is used in a lot of engineering fields. However, petroleum engineering and chemical engineering are not fields that typically end up requiring this registered professional engineering certification. It's a lot less common in those areas. As a result, while there's been a recent search for a replacement for our chief administrator of the Oil and Gas Commission, we've had a difficult time finding applicants that had that professional certification, a professional engineering license as a petroleum engineer or a chemical engineer. Consequently, we've been unable to fill that vacancy, even though we've had a lot of applicants that were otherwise very qualified and would have been willing to take that position. So we bring this piece of legislation trying to correct and acknowledge the fact that the marketplace has shifted. This requirement is no longer a necessity for the state to perform its business. The incoming chief administrator would be selected based on their qualifications by the commission, and would require that 10 years of experience in a relevant position with respect to field of expertise. So the committee was comfortable that we're still maintaining a very high standard in our selection of an administrator for the Oil and Gas Commission, and that this is a reasonable approach while still protecting the interests of the people.
Majority floor leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I would like to have a little more discussion. It seems to me, and my concern is that while it may have been true for a period of time where petroleum engineers relied less on their professional engineering stamps, with the events in the Gulf that's changed, that we are now getting to a point to where we have things like fracking, we have things that are important. And when we're achieving such high revenues from our population, when we're dealing with our groundwater, I really wonder what the wisdom, the experience I understand, but the wisdom of saying you don't have to have your professional engineering stamp, is that really what we want? Because not only is it bringing the expertise, but this is an office that requires great credibility. And it seems to me, and one of my concerns is that if we're unwilling to pay for that chief officer to have that registration, the PE registration, let's pay him more. Look at our revenues. Look at what we have at risk if we don't have a credibility for this position. And those PE stamps mean something. And maybe an alternative to be discussed is whether you can go ahead and hire an engineer with this experience, but we would expect within a year that he would sit for the exams and achieve his PE rating. And if he certainly can't do that within a year, you have to wonder what the problem is. And this is an important position. I'm concerned that we're driving this because we're unwilling to pay the cost of having somebody with the PE stamp and worried about the long-term credibility of our most important industry.
Senator Bebop, as soon as they find you. I got you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Those points are valid points, but it's not so much the technical side as what's happening with the Oil and Gas Commission is involving more and more into administrative duties. And so what you're seeing is a situation where the people that are registered professional engineers and their expertise, they may not have the qualifications. We're not seeing the kind of candidates that are coming in that can do the administrative side. Money is a part of it, but it's also the administrative side of it. And then don't forget, too, that within the Oil and Gas Commission, you know, we have a lot of expertise internally in that to evaluate these things that are submitted. It's not that the Oil and Gas Commissioner, the executive, the person that runs the commission, is going to make those engineering decisions. He has a staff to do that. He's more of an administrator. I will tell you, the members of the Senate, that when we had this discussion during the interim, that the industry is split. I mean, a lot of people think this should still be a requirement. And they think you should have a registered professional engineer or a registered professional geologist. I would also tell you that there are other engineers out there in the industry that may have a civil or a mechanical or an electrical engineering degree that certainly could do this job, but they're not even afforded the opportunity because they're not a professional petroleum engineer or a geologist. So it's an issue that deserves some really good discussion here. And the idea of my colleague from Albany County about after they get the job maybe sitting for the exam might be something that we might want to consider. You know, the way you get your professional engineering exam, most of you are probably familiar with it, is you sit for an EIT, engineering training exam, and you sit for that usually right after you've graduated, then you have to have so many years of professional experience, and you sit for another exam. Probably most of those people have done the EIT, and for whatever reason, they may not have done the professional engineering exam. But that's the discussion we had with the committee during the interim. And again, we're trying to facilitate a situation where we think we can get the balance between administrative expertise and yet have the experience to understand what's going on to run the department.
Majority floor here.
Mr. Chairman, it seems to me that we shouldn't be sacrificing either. We have many, many examples where we have engineers who have sat for their professional engineering and are great administrators. But let's not forget one of the, let's take example. We had this discussion not too long ago with our state geologist. And the state geologist does a lot of things, include testifying in front of committees, going in front of Congress, setting policies, trying to give counsel to our companies in a very important area. And one of the primary things that these folks do is they're witnesses. There are witnesses. There are professional witnesses. And it happens to be that I come from a community full of professors, people that do this for a living. They're all some are professional engineers, some are not. But I can tell you that when you look at that industry and when you begin to look at the testimony that's being given, and if you're talking about fracking, if you're talking about injury to your water, and what we should be doing as a state to protect all of those things, the credibility of our chief representatives is huge. And that profession, that stamp means something. It means that they sat for that exam, and it makes no sense to me right now why we would want to have the issue of a professional, whether it be a professional geologist or an electrical engineer. I'd like to hear more than that, but I got to think that if the state of Wyoming wants to have a seat in Congress, do we really want to have an electrical engineer go talk to Congress, or do we want a professional petroleum engineer and one who has sat for the exam? And I can understand why folks might not want to sit for that exam, but they should have the intellectual capacity at that time, and we can provide we can pay for it. So you go sit for the exam, but we expect you to pass that. And I'm a great concern that when we have hearings, when we have these folks testify on our behalf, that they be looked upon by others as the best in the field.
Senator Scott, as soon as I find you here, okay.
Mr. Chairman, speaking on and for the bill, I think one of the things you need to be aware of is going on in the engineering profession. We heard
considerable about this in the Corporation's Interim Committee is they're moving away from some of these highly specialized professional engineering categories and tending to lump them together. And I think this language will adapt well as that change progresses over the various states and the registered professional petroleum engineer becomes scarce compared to just registered professional engineers. The language that's being repealed here is too restrictive, and as we can see, it's giving us trouble filling a key position. So I hear the objection, but when you really need an expert witness or something, then you've got to go out and hire that. But you've got to have somebody who's knowledgeable to run the shop, and you need to have a broad pool of applicants to choose from.
Senator Schiffer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question. In looking at this bill, I looked at what, under the Oil and Gas Commission, what their job is. And one of them is to, as I recall, promote and enhance oil and gas production in the state. And in view of the information we just got a short while ago, that is a crucial role. I understand the regulatory role is important. But enhancing oil and gas, what is the effect of this change going to have on that? In other words, is the person that's qualified under the new criteria still going to be able to sit down and have a discussion on how do we make the either the volume of gas or the barrels of oil or how do we enhance it? Is it going to impact that role at all? Does this make no difference?
Mr. Majority, which one? Mr. Majority Floor Leader or Rothfuss? Or Minority Floor Leader, but that's close.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, addressing a couple of the issues that we heard, I'll start with the last one about whether or not it will make a difference for that enhancing the oil and gas in the state. And it really won't. It's not as if you're going to end up then that there's some magical threshold where professional engineers know about oil and gas and engineering, and if you don't have that certification, you don't. In my experience, I haven't even found out whether people are professional engineers typically because it doesn't come up. And it's true that my colleague from Albany County points out that there are some instances and situations where you need that professional engineering certificate to authorize and stamp. When I see a PE after somebody's name, typically what that tells me is that they've worked in a lot of contracts, government contracts, that they have to sign off on buildings and architecture and major constructions. But personally, I've seen no delineation or separation between professional engineers and people without PEs in chemical engineering and in petroleum over the years. Now, My colleague from across town is certainly right. We can achieve exactly what we ask for in the current statute just by paying more money. If we kick the price tag up to $400,000 or $500,000 a year, we'll have our applicants. We'll fill the job. But that's what it's going to take to do this role is something up in that area where you can draw a pool of applicants that has everything you want. And I don't believe that this particular role requires a $500,000 a year salary. I think we can do it with a more modest salary as long as we recognize that we don't have to have all of the bells and whistles attached to the position. But I'm certainly sensitive to the concerns here, and we want to make sure that we have a very credible applicant. There's certainly nothing in the legislation as it would be changed to be written that would prohibit having a professional engineer in that position if that's the best applicant available. And if the commission does not feel comfortable hiring somebody based on their experience, I would have every expectation that they would hold the window open until somebody comes along that they feel is adequate. But I agree with the sensitivity to the concerns. I'm comfortable certainly with the new language as amended, but I agree that it's something we have to take very seriously as a body and make sure that we're not diminishing the authority and credibility of that important position in the state of Wyoming.
Senator Esquivel.
Mr. Chairman, I have no knowledge whether registered professional engineer is necessary or not necessary. I have no way of knowing. I guess the concern that I have is that it seems like the impetus for this came about because we were unable to find a person that was qualified having that degree. As to whether today it's needed or not, I have no way of knowing. But it's, like I said, the concern was because of the way it came up that we couldn't find a qualified professional engineer, and it's because of that 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 raises some concerns in my mind anyway. Thank you.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I guess what gives me some concern continues after the discussion is the notion that the duties that are presently assigned to this person simply don't warrant paying the extra money to get somebody that's got a PE stamp. And and I assume that these folks are going to the industry, and if the industry is paying more for somebody with these PE stamps, it's for a reason. And when I hear that the argument that, well, in these certain areas we can go out and hire expertise and we can hire consultants, well, now you've got embedded the same amount in your budget. You just got, you're paying less for an administrator, and now you're paying for the experts. When I look at the salaries that are commanded for folks that we have doing the Wyoming infrastructure, experts that we've done for the gas pipeline entity that we fund, and we've created a number of ways to address those issues. Now, folks, the salary for this person is paid for by the industry. The industry pays a tax to the Oil and Gas Commission, and that tax then pays for the entire operation of the Oil and Gas Commission. So it's not paid for out of the fund, or not out of our general fund, I believe. I think it comes out of that tax that's raised. And the amount of tax that's required to pay the command a salary, if it's in the $200,000-$300,000 range, is pretty insignificant. But, folks, we have so much at stake in our industry, in maintaining our minerals, that if I look back 3 years from now and said, gee, if we had just had somebody at that hearing that would have been considered a little bit higher credibility, and the testimony would have gone a little more favorable, we'd have made another 0.25%. You're talking hundreds of millions of dollars. And I guess the assurance I'm looking for from, and we've got folks that are industry experts, and I know we've got engineers that are industry experts. And the question is, have they thought about, and have we really fully thought about, the consequences that might happen just because we're unwilling to pay somebody the commanding rate for that certification? Not to say that we won't get bright people, but the industries, if the salaries are there, they're commanded for a reason.
Mr. Vice President.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of things to share with the body is, the oil and gas commissioners that are appointed by the governor, we had quite a bit of discussion with them, including the now sitting interim director of the Oil and Gas Commission. And for all the reasons we've talked about, we're very supportive of doing this. If you look at the industry and the type of individual that we're trying to attract to this, if you talk about a PE out of college, there's a high demand for an engineer like that with a PE degree out of college versus a typical engineer that may not have that. There's no question about that. But those aren't the kind of people that we're trying to get to work in this particular job. We're talking about somebody that has an experience in the industry, been out there and been doing it. Now, there's clearly two things that person needs to do. There's the regulatory side, Now, obviously, being a professional engineer, you're going to have a leg up in that environment because that's what you've been trained to do. But you also have the expertise within house, or you can go get it to take care of that. Then there's the other side of it, like my colleague from Johnson County talks about, and that's from the view from 30,000 feet of what this is all about and how do we enhance and improve and get more reserves, drill more wells, whatever. The other thing I would say, although it's not a really good comparison of it in terms of apples and apples, but I look at other departments that we have within state government, and I can remember some discussion we had about the Department of Health, and people at one time thought that should be an MD. And do you really need an MD to be the Department of Health because of a lot of the issues, or you do truly need an administrator? And it's not exactly the same, but it gives you a flavor for what we're trying to do. Part of it, of course, is being able to even recruit people to do it. And I don't know if all of you are aware of it, but they had, I think, 6 or 7 applicants the last go-around that submitted their, or maybe there's more than that, that submitted the names to the commission. They submitted 4 more names to the governor. The governor looked at those. I think 4 of them were registered professional engineers. 1 was not. The governor chose the one that was not. He thought it was the most qualified, offered him the job. Things changed. He did not do it, so we're back looking again. It's a call of this body, obviously. There's pros and cons to it. I happen to think that the best argument about it, and the colleague from Albany County makes that, nothing precludes the governor or the commission from saying, oh, by the way, we still want you to be a registered professional engineer.
Are you ready? Question. Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Hines' motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 3, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no.
No.
Okay. Senate File 3 has passed the committee of the whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 10. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 10, Supreme Court Decisions and Session Law, sponsored by the Judiciary Committee, and Act relating to the Supreme Court. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Schiffer. Senator Schiffer, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Schiffer?
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise to report it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 10, Supreme Court Decisions and Session Laws, and to explain this good little Senate file, I yield the floor to Senator Christensen.
Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 10 is really about a little bit of housekeeping, but also it's about efficiency. We have a bill here that takes what was mandatory, and that is the mandatory distribution of the opinions and session laws, and makes it an optional in May. What we found out in this discussion was that a lot of the organizations, the bodies that are receiving these books, have come back with comments saying, we don't really want the book. We'd rather have it in an electronic, a digital form. It's plugging up our shelves, and we're getting overwhelmed with books, and we'd rather switch to the digital format. The department right now has a $45,000 to $50,000 budget that they spend on a biannual basis just for this. If you look at the bill, and we don't necessarily need to read all of it, but they're distributed from the Supreme Court to the district judges, to the counties, the Attorney General of the United States, the Supreme Court of the United States District Court, other states and territories and governments. So we're putting these books out all over based on this statute, and we have had requests to please not send the book, but instead have it in a digital form. This bill doesn't mandate that we're only going with the digital form. It's optional based on the on our courts and on the requesting agencies, but the opportunity to save some money is significant here. They don't know how much it'll be, but they anticipate that it will increase the request to stay with the digital format. There's a little bit of clarifying language on here, page 2 on line 9 and 10. It says a copy to the office of the United States District Judge and the clarifier is there, just corrects it to go district court. But the rest of the language that's really being changed is all about the option to save some money to give people the product they're asking for.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, question being called. All those in favor of Senator Schiffer's motion that when the committee of the whole rise to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 10. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Senate File 10 has passed the committee of the whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 12. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 12, Child Support Payment Procedures, sponsored by the Judiciary Committee, an act relating to child support payments. It was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Schiffer. Senator Schiffer, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Schiffer?
Mr. Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise to report it do so with a favorable recommendation for Senate File 12, Child Support Payment Procedures, and to explain this good Senate file, I yield the floor to Senator Hicks.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, members of this body, this is just purely a house cleaning bill that the clerks have brought to us. Basically, we had some discrepancies in the language, and all this does is make it consistent all the way through as far as dealing with the clerks. If you'll turn to page 2, you'll just see that it clears it up, and it basically says all the way through as defined by the clerk and takes out those two kind of conflicting differences. So it's purely a house cleaning mechanism to make conforming language all the way through the statutes.
Further discussion. Okay, question being called. All those in favor of Senator Schiffer's motion that when the committee of the whole rise to report, to do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 12, all say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Senate File 12 has passed the committee of the whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 23. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 23, Challenge Loan Program Natural Gas Vehicle Infrastructure, sponsored by the Minerals Committee, and Act Relating to Economic Development. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Anderson, O2, Senators Cole, Cooper, Hines, and Rothfuss, Senator Hines, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it does so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File Number 23. There is no standing committee amendments. I will move the bill and yield to Senator Cole to explain the bill.
Senator Cole.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this bill is brought to you by the Joint Minerals Committee that had extensive discussion in the interim. And as you might know, the natural gas vehicles, we have done some things in Wyoming to develop fleets and to provide for that. Compressed natural gas, I will draw your attention to this handout, pretty much breaks down exactly what's going on in Wyoming. We have a few natural gas filling stations out there, but not enough. What this bill does, it goes into the, it would allow the Wyoming Business Council to provide direct, low-cost loans for the build-out of private natural gas vehicle fueling infrastructure. As I said, we have converted some government fleet vehicles already, and we have some filling stations out there. Just to move on to the bill, what it really does, it allows $5 million out of the Challenge Loan Program. It allows for up to $1 million per entity to apply for that. Now, remember that these filling stations cost between anywhere from $500,000 to $1.2 million. It does limit the amount of money out of the program to $5 million, so there's only going to be $5 million out there initially. Drawing your attention to this handout, we currently have seven public stations. Cheyenne, Evanston, Riverton, Rock Springs has two, Pinedale, and Afton. Have four private stations out there in Bags, Lyman and Rock Springs, one planned for Laramie, two planned in Rawlins and Cheyenne, but there's about 15 desired out there if you really want to be able to do this. The problem and the reasons for the loan is these people go out and apply, and they can put anywhere from $500,000 to $1 million into one of these filling stations, but the vehicles might not be out there yet. So we give them a two-year hiatus on interest and principal before they have to start paying it back. Pretty simply, that's what the bill does. It had extensive debate in the interim with the Minerals Committee. There's a real push towards natural gas vehicles, particularly with school buses. That's something that's being talked about. That's what the bill does. I'd ask for your support, and I'd stand for questions.
Senator Case. Then we'll go to Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I have a concern about this bill, and that it's the same concern I often bring when the government, the state of Wyoming, tries to choose winners and losers with respect to private industry. What this bill does is take state money and use it to underwrite private industry. I don't think that's a proper function of government. I don't think that it's a necessary function. And I think that, we're better served by letting free markets work, Mr. Chairman. You can't really tell me, Mr. Chairman, that some of the major people involved in fueling vehicles in this country are missing capital. Some of the big names you see that are in the petroleum industry, for example. And you can't tell me that this isn't going to be a business that's going to work out in the long term, and it's worth entrepreneurs to take the risk and get involved in this. And we are already partnering with them because we are mandating conversion of public vehicles to burn natural gas. The way we could help that along is not supply the natural gas fuel through the public sector, but to allow private people to supply that fuel. We don't need to get in here and to have subsidized loans to private industry for this technology. Now, everybody would probably like to have natural gas vehicles come faster, have this market develop, fine. But that's not a reason for government intervention. That's not a reason to subsidize private industry. And remember, you're picking winners and losers. What if you've got more than one applicant, people who want to compete for each other? How do I go compete with Station X when they have subsidized pricing from the state of Wyoming? You know, it's just a philosophy, thank you, Mr. Chairman, that you have to...
You're welcome.
You know, you have to, like, draw the line, and you have to say, oh, there's a little bit of working out the kinks of this market, but it's not a reason for the state of Wyoming to jump in with both feet and throw our money around. Private sector does a darn good job. Give them time to develop. Let them take the risks and work out the kinks. Don't do it with private or public dollars. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to call the body's attention to page 4, lines 22 and 23. It says, notwithstanding WS 912-302B, interest shall not accrue on the loan for the first 2 years of the loan. Now, 912-303, in that area there, I believe that has to do with the interest rate that and when things have to be paid. And I think that's a minimum of 4% on these loans. The good folks from the Minerals Committee might correct me if I'm wrong on that, but I think that you at least have to pay 4% if you're going to pay. But I'm a little concerned about the language on 22 and 23, where we're basically giving away the use of the state's money for absolutely nothing. I'd feel a lot more comfortable if that interest would accrue to the principal of the loan. And at least that way the state would get it back. It had the same effect of what the bill is purporting, is to allow the folks that are building these stations some potential cash flow in the first 2 years while the public understands where the stations are and the cars get on the road. So they wouldn't necessarily have money coming out of their pocket. but they still owe the 4% to the state or accrue to the balance of the loan. I think that's a reasonable compromise, especially in light of the eloquent persuasion from the good senator from Fremont County, whom from time to time I tend to agree with. And I think that in this case, Mr. Chairman, I think this would be a good compromise. And something like that, if this bill moves to second reading, I may want to bring something like that forward. So it's reasonable. The folks can get the loan, but they still owe the interest. It just goes to the principal.
Senator Dockstader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A clarification, and there's no doubt that we need this statewide network for natural gas. Here we are, a state with all these opportunities in natural gas, but a clarification of the 7, the 4, then the 3, all of this was done under private funding. Is that correct?
Mr. Vice President, Bebop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a mixed bag, and I think we can get the exact terminology. I know that in Riverton, it was done where the industry, more or less, and these particular facilities cost between $750,000 and $1 million apiece. Industry stepped up and provided some kind of a financial arrangement to do it in Riverton. I know that in Sublette County, the school district is being involved in, and there's some controversy over there on utilizing school dollars to put one of these facilities in. At the one at the University of Wyoming, and the majority floor leader recalls this very well, it's where YDOT, through funds that we appropriated last year, is going to be putting one in, and yet we had some language in there that said after a period of time, hopefully that will be bought by the private sector. So it's really a mixed bag, but I think we can get specifically what you want to have relative to how that all breaks out. And to talk to my colleague from Goshen County, you're right, the 312-301 B is that 4% that you're asking about. 912-302B, excuse me, deals with the 4% language.
Senator Von Flader, as soon as I find you here. Okay, gotcha.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 5, line 4, I just want a clarification. It says that subsection A of this section does not apply to natural gas fueling infrastructure loans. So, and A is about community, the money can only go from the council to community development, I believe, or something of that nature. Community development organizations, state development organizations. Does that mean that this money could actually be, could be construed to go to private entities, which we know we can't do directly, but since that takes A out of there, what does that leave us with?
Is there any notes? Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, we just discussed that briefly, and the answer, I asked that question, and currently the loans are not to private, completely private. They're for community or state development organizations. And by saying that subsection A does not apply, it means that private businesses can go in and get the loans just like a government development organization.
Any further discussion? Mr. Majority Floor Leader, Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I would like to know what the discussion was in the committee. How then, if it's not to a community development organization, a CDO, or other public benefit, let's call it institution, how does the since it's a no-interest loan, meet the constitutional requirement that we can't give support to private industry under the Constitution?
Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, if I understand it correctly, then by putting this in there, it does not eliminate the government organizations that are or state development organizations. it adds, it allows the private, and whether that needs to be amended some way where it's correct the language where you was better understood. The way I understood it and took it to mean that a private business could go in and request a loan, or else a development organization that semi-government can also do it. They're the ones that do it currently.
Mr. Jordy Flordy. Oops. Okay. Any further discussion on this bill? Oh, excuse me. Senator Case. Sorry. You're so far over in the corner, I just missed you.
The extreme right, Mr. Chairman. And the rear, I might note.
The rear.
Mr. Chairman, Article 16, Section 6 of our Constitution is the loan of credit, donations prohibited, works of internal improvement. Neither the state nor any county, city, township, town, school, district, or any other political subdivision shall loan or give its credit or make donations to or in aid of any individual, association, or corporation, except for the necessary support of the poor. Mr. Chairman, how can we do this?
Mr. Vice President.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. This is the Challenge Loan Program. It's been in place for many years. We are doing these same things, have been doing them in the past, and the way it's structured certainly is not unconstitutional. All we're doing with this in terms of the Challenge Loan Program is expanding it so we will allow the opportunity for some of these CNGs to participate under it. The Challenge Loan Program is in place, has been in place, and there's nothing out there that is set to change that. We're just expanding it.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, and I'm very supportive of the natural gas industry, but when you use the word expansion, the Challenge Loan Program can only go to a governmental entity. That's the way the loans are set up. The top of page 5, lines 1 through 7, says that's no longer true, that now it can go to a private entity, and I believe that is unconstitutional.
Mr. Minority Floor Leader Rothfuss. Oops, sorry, John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're next, John.
Mr. Chairman, I do think those are valid concerns that we might want to look at addressing in a second reading amendment on this to see if there is a better way to phrase that such that it's not a clear handover to the private sector. I believe the intention was not to violate the spirit of the original Challenge Loan Program, which Mr. Vice President has indicated is, you know, well established and has done an excellent job of stimulating this economic development. So perhaps there's a better way that we can clarify that in a second reading amendment. I think it would be worthwhile to look into that.
Senator Hines, were you willing to speak? Sorry, Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, when the distinguished senator in the corner stood up, I knew what the question was going to be. And quite frankly, I forgot it, or I would have brought the same thing up in committee yesterday. But as we discussed the issue, and I'm not fast enough to understand this part of it, we did pass a constitutional amendment, and I haven't had time to read it. It's on page 58 in our Constitution, and I'm guessing some way in there that takes care of this. But what I think we need to do is I'd like to ask you to move the bill forward, and we'll get on that and see if we can get a amendment that clarifies it, or else, if necessary, get an opinion whether we're right or wrong.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, the constitutional provision in question is Article 16, Section 12, and basically there's a limitation on how much money, and the appropriation involved requires a two-thirds vote of the legislature. I don't know that the funds in this particular section that's being referenced have gone through those that two-thirds vote. But as you craft amendments, you might want to look at that and make sure that there is capacity, because there's a limitation in that of 1% of the assessed value of the taxable property of the state. So you have to make sure you're under the limit and then amend it such that this $5 million is an appropriation, which would maybe ought to require consideration of the Appropriations Committee and would then require the bill to get a two-thirds vote. So there is a mechanism there to get around the 16-6 provision if we think it's important enough.
Senator Landon, sorry. What was your name?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope this will be a relatively simple question. There's been an awful lot of interest up in the center part of the state for the development of such a network. And my question, I just simply don't know enough about the Challenge Loan Program to know if school districts would be allowed to work under this granting authority. Is that something that school districts can they avail themselves to this program that we're trying to set up?
Minority floor leader, are you?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to clarify a couple of things there. As far as the appropriation aspect, the good senator from Catrona County mentioned, the senior senator, there's no appropriation in this because it's basically expanding what you can do under the Challenge Loan Program. So theoretically, those appropriations have already been committed to the program, and there's no additional appropriation. So I'm not sure whether or not that would get around the two-thirds requirement that you're discussing, but that's certainly something that we need to look at. The other point regarding the school districts that we just heard, I don't believe there would be any possibility for eligibility by the school districts under this program. We certainly have the other discussions and previous legislation to look at for school districts, but I don't believe they would be eligible for the Challenge Loan Program.
Senator Von Fladen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Always a pleasure. When you're crafting the amendments, I would look at page 4, lines 19 and 20, where they refer to the state shall have priority over any claim of the business receiving, and that may need to be amended if we are not giving money directly to a private business, and if we are, I guess it really won't matter.
Mr. Vice President, DeVos.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of things, and we may need to take a look at this, but when you read the statutes, it says that except as otherwise provided under Wyoming Statute 912, 3 or 4, C through G, then it would go to community development organizations or state development organizations. Then if you look at those exceptions, it clearly says now in existing law, any business may apply to the council for bridge financing as defined in Wyoming Statute 912-301A6, meaning they can do that, and then that requirement, if you go back and look at that, is mean it's a guaranteed loan participation, which means a provision of financing by the council, that be the business council, in which the council participates with the lender that has a secured a federal guaranteed loan. The Challenge Loan Program participates with banks to do these loan guarantees. And that's how it's always been worked. And so I'm just hopefully that clarifies it, and we can sure look about that H provision. But I think we already do this now, where business participates with a guaranteed provision to do bridge financing. That's the whole purpose of the Challenge Loan Program in the first place.
Any further discussion? Okay. All those in favor of Senator Hines's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 23, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say no.
No.
The chair is undecided. Will all those who are in favor say, please stand. All those who are opposed, please stand.
Senate File 23 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next...
Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Majority Floor Leader. You've heard the motion. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed say no. We'll stand at ease. Thank you. Yep. You can have that back, and I'll take mine, I guess. Yeah, I'll just leave that there. So. Let's leave my water here, okay, please. It's okay. Okay. What's my response? Okay. All right. Did they vote? Did we vote? Had they already voted on that? All right. Okay. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk. Announcements?
Senator Geis. The Committee Number 5, Public Land Water, Water Resources and Natural Resources, will have a meeting upon adjournment this afternoon. We're going to take up Senate File 7. Conservation District Spatial Expertise, Senate File 20, State Land Transactions, Senate File 31, Wyoming Veterinary Medical Practice Act.
Are there announcements? Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is an informational announcement. Tomorrow morning at 7:30, there's going to be a telecommunications kind of primer workshop in room 302. It's developed by the Corporations Committee in the House, who are practically all brand new folks, and we do have a little bit of telecommunications work this year. All the senators are, of course, invited. People in the Corporations Committee, it'd be nice if you showed up. It'd make us look kind of camaraderie and kind of things. So it's tomorrow morning at 7:30.
Senator, Mr. Vice President.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, will continue budget hearings this afternoon starting at 3 o'clock. I'm not going to go through the list. Just a heads up for the committee is we may have a meeting tomorrow, Friday at noon, to deal with a re-referral. Just a heads up.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. Heads, a reminder that we have the training at 1 o'clock for the Outlook. And with that, I move that we rise and sit again at 2 p.m.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? We're in recess until 2 p.m.